Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the program today, big banks, the Russian economy, and White House public relations, video games as a viable livelihood, and our series, Disappearing Jobs. Today, how your clothes get made. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, the 16th of April today. Glad, as always, to have you with us. And we will begin today, I think, with a dispatch from the financial sector. Big banks have been disclosing first quarter profits this week, and they are, simply put, all over the map. Down at JPMorgan Chase, up at Wells Fargo, down at B of A, up at Citigroup. Specific details, of course, vary, but at least one thing stands out. Americans are doing a better job paying down their mortgages and their credit cards. Dan Bobkoff has that story for us.
Good work, America. You're getting a lot more responsible about your debt.
This is not an unusual phenomenon.
Nancy Bush is a banking analyst.
It normally goes on after a financial brush with death, like the one that we had in the years 2005 to 2008.
Both consumers and the big banks have changed their ways since those dark days. Banks are more cautious about who they lend to, and we are a lot more careful with our credit cards and other loans, says Steve Chalky of the credit reporting agency TransUnion.
Credit card and auto delinquencies have been hovering around all-time lows for the last several quarters.
Look at just about any big bank's earnings report lately, and the trends are clear. JPMorgan Chase's earnings, for instance, shows four charts under the heading Delinquency Trends. All of them, whether home loans or credit cards, point straight down since 2010. Total U.S. home loan delinquencies are down more than 12% versus last year, according to Black Knight Financial. But this isn't just because Americans are getting better managing debt. Banks have been much stricter, says Black Knight's Kostia Graducci.
In order to get a mortgage loan these days, you need to have a high credit score. So basically, these new borrowers are already more responsible.
But all this responsibility can have a downside for the economy. Careful, responsible Americans tend to spend less. So this news won't thrill retailers. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
The number of the day this Wednesday, it's in dollars, by the way, is 50 million, 50 million. That's how much former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg is going to spend this year fighting the National Rifle Association on gun control. This isn't the first time Mr. Bloomberg has thrown a huge sum of money at a cause. He's given $50 million to fight coal companies, to clean up the oceans, and to promote women's reproductive rights. But what does he get for his money? Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
Bloomberg's $50 million is a huge amount to spend on gun control in a single year. The NRA spent just under $3.5 million on lobbying in 2013, and the Brady Campaign, a gun control advocacy group, has an annual budget of just over $3 million. Bloomberg's $50 million will go to a network of smaller nonprofits organized under one large umbrella group called Every Town for Gun Safety.
I think the fact that the mayor is saying that he wants to merge groups is one of the things that's most important about this message.
Stacey Palmer is the editor of the Chronicle for Philanthropy. She says this money will help these smaller grassroots groups eliminate some of the redundancy in their organization.
And so this allows them to consolidate it and have one back office, probably, that takes care of everything, and that'll make them a lot more efficient.
Most nonprofits rely on a trickle of funding that allows them to run their day-to-day operations. But big donations like this one, says Professor of Philanthropic Studies Mark Hager, allows groups to fund big campaigns on a particular issue.
It can stop and take stock of that and really give its attention to that particular marketing or lobbying effort.
Now, private foundations are prohibited from lobbying for legislation and supporting political campaigns.
But private foundations are allowed to spend as much money as they want on educating.
Joanne Barkin writes about private foundations like Bloomberg's, the Koch brothers, and the Gates. She says the difference between private foundations educating a member of Congress and lobbying one is often impossible to distinguish. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Wall Street today, up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Oh, we love our gadgets. We do. We want them small, we want them light, and we want them long-lasting. Small we got. light we got. The only problem is that last bit, and that comes down to physics. Marketplace's Queen of Kim has the battery story.
The smartwatch has been the techie dream since forever.
It's here at last, the new Dick Tracy.
And there's a lot of excitement about it lately because the mobile revolution has finally shrunk the computing that once sat on our desktop onto our wrist.
Tracy to kids. Come in, kids.
Mark Vandenberg is a venture capitalist at Technology Partners in Palo Alto, California. He says while the electronics have shrunk, the batteries that power them haven't. On an iPhone, for example, the battery takes up nearly half the real estate.
If my watch is going to become my new smartphone, and I don't want the watch to be a nice piece of jewelry and for me to have to wear a big armband battery next to it.
That problem is sparking a renewed interest in battery technology among tech companies and investors in Silicon Valley. But Vandenberg says the battery problem extends well beyond wearables into electric cars and renewable energy.
The investment community sees the need, certainly consumer electronics, but we also have the automobile marketplace, and we have utility-scale storage devices. All three of those things are the demand that the investment community has woken up to.
Just down the road from Vandenberg, Yi Choi is working in his lab. He's the CEO of a venture-backed startup called Amprius.
So I wear two hats. I'm a professor at Stanford, so I do research here.
Choi's team is testing the boundaries of battery technology.
My group invented paper batteries and textile batteries.
That's paper and textile batteries. Choi says batteries are hard to develop because they live in the world of material science. Or very simply put, it all depends on finding the right material. Sometimes materials like paper don't hold enough charge. Or others, like precious metals, can be too expensive. And often, they can be dangerous.
The safety concern is there. Make sure the packaging is good. You don't leak out anything bad to your body.
Sorting through these issues takes a lot of research, time, and testing.
We are doing charge and discharge testing.
Choi's showing me his battery testing machine. It's around 4 feet high and has 100 little slots. In them, flat silver button batteries like the ones you see in a watch. He's testing batteries made with silicon.
We call it the button cell, the corn cell we made.
Corn, you said?
Yeah, C-O-I-N,
oh,
corn.
Coin cell.
Corn cell.
Oh, but inside the coin is the silicon.
That's right. Inside
Choi says silicon allows the battery to last 25% longer than other batteries, and he's got venture capital money to research and develop it further. He says he's produced a small number of batteries for Asian smartphone manufacturers. Jim Kim is a venture capitalist at Formation 8, and he's rooting for Amprius. But he says
there's a valley of death that exists between the research lab and commercialization.
He says while venture capitalists might be funding the research, nobody is paying to manufacture the batteries on a mass scale, at least not in the U.S.
If we think about what needs to be done, you have to build a plant, and that's very expensive. And this is a process that takes a long time to tune. You have to be safe with it. If you make a mistake, it's catastrophic.
Kim says a battery factory can cost up to hundreds of millions of dollars. While the electric car maker Tesla has talked about building a battery factory, Kim says it's mainly Korean conglomerates like LG that are getting into the space.
And then you've had Panasonic, Samsung, companies like BYD and Lixin in China who have built their factories on the back of government subsidies. Those are the players which are now dominating the market. And that's a shame.
It's a shame, he says, because while there's no doubt that the U.S. is a leader in developing batteries, it's ceding the manufacturing to somebody else. In San Francisco, I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
We talked a little bit about the Ukrainian economy yesterday on the broadcast. Today, the Russian side of that equation, as the European Union threatens more sanctions on Russia if there is no progress at talks that start in Switzerland tomorrow. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Russia's economy slowed sharply over the past 3 months. The economy minister told Parliament in Moscow today the Ukrainian crisis had spooked investors. Capital is fleeing the country at a record rate. Earlier in the week, the finance minister forecast the economy would see zero growth this year. Raoul Ruparel is with the Open Europe think tank in London.
Everything seems to be going the wrong direction for Russia at the moment, and it's really down to increasing uncertainty around the situation in Ukraine and potential sanctions.
So far, the US and the Europeans have imposed travel bans and asset freezes on certain Russian officials. The EU has threatened further sanctions if Russia continues what the EU calls its provocation. But Derek McDowell of the Maplecroft Research House says Russian President Vladimir Putin is undeterred. He still seems intent on throwing his weight around in Ukraine.
These kind of nationalist sentiments, these kind of regathering of Russian lands kind of campaign is taking precedence over more practical, if you want, economic ambitions.
And Sam Charup of the International Institute for Strategic Studies points out we should not exaggerate the Russians' economic vulnerability.
They have the third largest hard currency reserves in the world that could deal with some of the short-term impacts of this. So I don't see a dramatic, acute, short-term economic impact.
Unless Europe bans imports of Russian oil and gas or bars Russian banks from dealing in European financial markets. But that drastic action seems highly unlikely, unless Russia invades eastern Ukraine. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
At the White House this afternoon, more than a dozen deans of business schools gathered to talk about women and the workplace and how to make that a better combination. It was part of a lead-up to a bigger Working Families Summit, coming in June, apparently. The White House holds a lot of these sorts of gatherings. There have been summits on everything from job creation to food marketing. How much actually gets done, though? Well, here's Marketplace's Amy Scott.
Bill Boulding is dean of the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University, where just 34% of MBA students are women. He hoped to come away from today's meeting with ideas to make business more inclusive for women and people with families.
You're going to be more creative. You're going to be more productive. You're going to be more innovative in terms of a whole series of performance measures.
Other recent White House gatherings have addressed diversity in the tech industry and success for black men. But how much really comes out of these summits? Bob Gutman teaches media and politics at Johns Hopkins University.
Sure, everybody likes to come to the White House, come to Washington, have their picture taken. But in terms of policy, I think it's less important.
Still, a national spotlight can raise awareness, says Jody Detchen, who teaches management at Suffolk University in Boston.
It needs to come from the top. As soon as people say from the top, it's important, then businesses will start investing in it, colleges will start investing in it, and people will start to realize, oh, it does matter.
One way to make these events more than a photo op, ask for specific commitments, like the White House did when college presidents got together a few months ago to talk about expanding opportunity for low-income students. Daniel Porterfield is president of Franklin and Marshall College in Pennsylvania, one of 10 schools that pledged hundreds of new scholarships. And the group met again at the White House a few weeks ago.
So just that one project alone, clearly there's been some great momentum from the convening in January.
Porterfield says the biggest impact of these gatherings isn't on policymakers, but on those who attend. They can bring new ideas back to their universities and businesses. But he says sometimes it takes the White House to get the ball rolling. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Nobody ever realizes that people are involved in the making of your clothes anymore. People just assume that it's a machine that makes your clothes.
Au contraire, our series Disappearing Jobs in just a minute. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. The Dow Industrial's up 162 points today, 1% on the nose, closed at 16,424. The NASDAQ advanced 52 points, 1.2%, ended things at 4,086, while the S&P 500 drove up 19 points, 1% there as well, ended at 1862. Yahoo powered up more than 6% today on the back of yesterday's profit reports. Apple rose 0.2%. And while Google did rise 3.75% during the day, fell nearly 5% in after-hours trading following the release of some disappointing profit numbers. Bank of America withdrew 1.5% after it reported a loss today. Citigroup followed suit, fell about 0.25%. Bond prices fell as well. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.64%. You're listening to Marketplace.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. NASA is scheduled to make an announcement, a discovery by its Kepler Space Telescope. Securities, salsa and soda, Goldman Sachs, Chipotle, and Pepsi are slated to report quarterly earnings. And events continue at the National Cathedral in Washington in observance of Holy Week. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from 8 p.m. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Here is today's entry in the Man I Totally Have the Wrong Job file. There's been an explosion the past couple of years in competitive online gaming, known as esports. Apparently, professional video game players face off, sometimes for hundreds of thousands of dollars, in arenas filled with tens of thousands of fans in matches that are broadcast around the world. Noah Nelson of Turnstile News has the story.
As it looks like two Envy players in the base, Krim checking all corners, let one player go out front, but didn't look left. And
two four-man teams of gamers, their shirts covered in corporate logos, play out an on-screen battle with intense focus. They, in turn, are observed by a studio audience, which peers into a control room constructed on a gunmetal stage. On the side of that stage are the play-by-play men, calling the action in suit and tie.
Sneaking through is going to make it a 2-1 lead for Complexity.
This is the sound of the World Championships for the video game Call of Duty, which had $1 million in cash prizes on the line in Los Angeles last month. These events are broadcast free online by Major League Gaming, an esports promoter that's been around since 2002, when most of America was on dial-up.
Internally, we refer to ourselves as the EESPN.
Sundance DiGiovanni is the co-founder and CEO of MLG.
I saw things like extreme sports taking off and realized that we were on the verge of this technological revolution that was going to allow us to have a global connected digital sport.
MLG built its success by promoting live events for shooter genre games like Call of Duty and Halo. These are pumped up versions of the gamer tradition of having friends over to play in front of the TV. The spread of broadband in the United States leveled the playing field, making it possible for even more gamers to compete as pros.
Without broadband internet, you simply can't practice games at a professional level.
Jason Lake should know. He's the founder and CEO of Complexity Gaming. Its Call of Duty team took home the $400,000 grand prize at the World Championship.
Complexity in its simplest form is, I guess you could say, like the LA Lakers of video games, except we play multiple games instead of just basketball.
It has the look of a lot of new media companies, one part talent agency, one part marketing firm. Complexity lets the players keep the competition prize money, instead making its revenue from marketing deals.
We're always keeping an eye on the next game because it's our business to do so, as we need to find the stars and get them under contract before our competition does.
Lake compares the current state of esports to the Wild West. MLG has locked up official Call of Duty matches and has even started its own streaming platform. Other promoters, like the Electronic Sports League, are using the game streaming juggernaut Twitch TV as their platform of choice.
In the top left, it's CJ Hero!
This recent match event in Katowice, Poland, drew more than 643,000 simultaneous viewers at its peak, double the previous record. A new generation of gamers is discovering esports, and what was once a subculture inside a subculture is on the verge of going mainstream. In Los Angeles, I'm Noah Nelson for Marketplace.
Noah's story was produced for us by Turnstile News. That's a project of Youth Radio. We did a series a couple of years ago about food, specifically about how we're going to feed all the people who are going to be living on this planet by the middle of the century. Food for 9 billion, it was called. The stories are, of course, on our website, should you be curious. National Geographic, though, is out in its new issue with a series of its own on how to handle our food dilemma. Jonathan Foley wrote the cover story for Feeding 9 Billion. John, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
We are going to have more people on this planet by the middle of the century, 2 billion or so more. And yet you say we need to double the amount of food we produce to feed everybody? Help me do the math.
Yeah, that's kind of the interesting dilemma we have. What's really happening is we have about 3-4 billion people in the world who are already here, who are getting richer. It's this new global middle class is China, India, Brazil, Russia, and all the rest. And as they've gotten richer, they're eating more and more meat and dairy products and more resource-consumptive foods. They're becoming more like the Europeans or, God forbid, like the American diet. So that's really why we're looking at a big explosion in food demand. One is population growth, but more importantly is the economic growth and associated changes in diet.
Even besides the math, there is another conundrum, I guess, in this piece that you wrote for National Geographic. You say we have to grow more food, we have to have more food, but you want us to freeze the world's agricultural footprint. That is the amount of land we are clearing to grow stuff, which is an extraordinary amount of land.
Oh, it really is. Right now, we use about 16 million square kilometers of land to grow crops, which is about the size of South America, to put that in perspective, and even more, about the size of Africa, to grow animals in our pastures and rangelands. In fact, 40% of all of the land on Earth is used to grow food right now. And if we want to double the amount of food, we can't just suddenly go to 80% of the planet, because a lot of that's desert or things we'd like to keep, like rainforest and ecosystems and biodiversity.
Is there a solution to be found in technology? I was out with Jim Fallows from The Atlantic in South Dakota a number of months ago, and I rode around on this GPS-guided tractor that was dropping seeds within a millimeter of where it was supposed to drop, and then it would come back and fertilize within that same millimeter and thus increasing the yield and eliminating, you know, yield gaps and all of that stuff.
Well, absolutely. That's one area of solution. I don't think it's a silver bullet, but it's a lot of silver buckshot over there, because it's allowing us to be much more precise and efficient with how we use chemicals, water, applying seeds, harvesting. You know, that's really appropriate kind of technology in maybe American farms, especially the big ones. But in other parts of the world, we have to kind of meet people where they are. It might be more low-tech approaches, like reusing cover crops and manures and compost. And I think we're going to need all of this stuff, a little bit of the high tech, a little bit of the medium tech, and a lot of the low tech. And maybe we'll pull it off.
And not only that, but just stop wasting stuff. I mean, the amount of food that goes into the trash can is crazy.
Well, that's the biggest opportunity of all, but it gets the least real serious attention. It turns out about 30, 40, maybe even 50% of all the food grown in the world is never consumed. And it's only when the math only works if you look at what we can do to grow more, but also save more of what we've grown and make sure it does the job it's intended to do, which is nourish people's lives.
John Foley wrote the cover story in the new National Geographic. It's their series called Feeding 9 Billion. It's about an 8-month or so long series. He's also the director of the Institute on the Environment up at the University of Minnesota. John, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Kai. I really appreciate it.
We talk every now and then on this program about the garment industry, which usually means where your clothes are made. Today, I want you to think about how they're made, or more specifically, the pattern that was used to figure out how long those sleeves ought to be and where the buttons ought to go. That's a job. It's called pattern making. And even though we're still all wearing just as many clothes as ever, it's a job that's going away. Our series about that is called Disappearing Jobs, and today it takes us to Chicago, where pattern maker Jen Beeman runs Grain Line Studios.
Nobody ever realizes that people are involved in the making of your clothes anymore. People just assume that it's a machine that makes your clothes. We're so removed from how our garments or products in general are made that they never assume that there's a person who does that. With pattern making, if you can imagine something you want to make, then you can make it because you have the tools to make the pattern to make that a reality. And that's really exciting to me, the creativity. What it involves is a large work table, brown paper, 90-pound craft paper, rulers, and a pencil. That's pretty much it. It's going away because computers are making things more efficient and you need less pattern makers to do the same amount of work. And also things are getting outsourced overseas where the garments are being made. But for me, it means that you need to be more creative and kind of think outside the box in order to make it a viable career. In 2009, I randomly started a blog and published my first pattern in, I think, 2010. And from there, it's taken off. There are people in high school who buy them, and I've had people email me who are like in their 80s. I'm just kind of flabbergasted that many people are using my patterns, and it's worldwide too, which blows my mind. I thought a lot about what I would do if I couldn't do pattern making, and I honestly can't come up with an answer, and I know that's super lame, but I just really love what I'm doing, and I just know that I'm really, really lucky to be able to do what I do.
That's Jen Beeman. She makes her patterns at Green Line Studios in Chicago. There is more of our series, Disappearing Jobs, at Marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, in which I'll pass on what I saw in the Wall Street Journal this morning. I will comment upon it and then have you guys tell me how wrong I am. The Journal has a story about fish sticks. Sales are down, apparently, and so the fish stick industry is looking to get kids excited about fish sticks again. I personally think that's going to be a tough haul because, ew. You should know, by the way, that I appear to be in a minority here at Marketplace Global Headquarters when it comes to feeling that way about fish sticks. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace on a fish stickless afternoon. It's from 8 p.m. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineered the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.